Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between law enforcement and cutting-edge science? Police departments around the world are expanding their use of DNA evidence to identify victims, find suspects, and protect innocent people from foul play. And a significant number of investigators using genetic materials in their work have trained or consulted with professionals at the University of North Texas Health Science Center in Fort Worth, which has been a pioneer in researching the ways that DNA can be used. Arthur Eisenberg is chair of the Department of Forensic and Investigative Genetics at the UNT Health Science Center and director of the Center for Human Identification. Art, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate being here.
Tell us a little bit about how DNA has changed the way criminal investigations are carried out from start to finish.
Well, DNA testing has really been used since about 1985 when we started the first DNA forensic lab in the world back in New York. I guess you can tell I'm not a native Texan, but as my father said, I got here as quick as I could. It's almost impossible today to commit a crime without leaving some type of biological sample, DNA evidence. We commonly shed hair, we touch things with our hands, we rub things with our bodies, and there's a transference of cells which can be used to identify yourself. So unless you're really very careful, like wearing bunny suits like you would do in a chip lab or something like that, it's somebody always leaves some type of biological evidence. And with the technologies that are currently available, we're able to look at smaller and smaller amounts of material. Literally only a few cells can be used to identify you.
So you talk about the mid-80s. Obviously, this was decades before the entire human genome had been mapped. What specific elements of those cells and the DNA within them are you looking for to make a match? How much do you need?
Well, it started off with some work done by a geneticist in the late 1970s that were able to identify regions of DNA. The term polymorphic typically refers to different variations that exist within coding regions of DNA. Now, the work that we look at, we don't look at coding regions. We don't look at anything that can determine our medical history and things like that. We look at regions that, as far as we know, do not code for anything. However, what's unique about them is that they can have many, many different variations. So at a particular region of DNA, we use the term locus. We can look at a region that could have 20 or 30 or 40 different variations. And typically, the regions we look at have variations based upon their size. The analogy that I like to use when we explain this in court, every train begins with an engine. Every train ends with a caboose. And the length of that train is determined by the number of cars in between the engine and the caboose. At the regions of DNA we look at, they have a repeating block. Typically, they have four letters, A, C, G, or T, or some combination of A, C, G, and T. And the number of times that block is repeated will determine the particular variation that we have. Humans are diploid, which means they have two copies of every piece of DNA. One copy we get from our mother in the egg. One copy we get from our father in the sperm. So at conception, our full complement of DNA is brought together. And the variations we get from our parents at these polymorphic, these highly variable regions, are what we look at for doing DNA testing.
So how unique is DNA to the individual as compared with older methods of identification like fingerprints?
Well, fingerprints, as far as we know, they're fairly unique. But compared to things like ABO blood typing, the proteins found on red cells or the proteins found on white cells, they're significantly more variable. We believe that any two individuals in the world, with the exception of identical twins, have unique DNA. Since identical twins are the product of one sperm and one egg, as that embryo, you know, as that fertilized egg begins to split, two cells, four cells, eight cells, at some point very early on, it splits and two fetuses, two babies are born. To the level that we can detect today, we can't distinguish identical twins. But any two other people can be distinguished using DNA.
So we've all seen this done on television, and this probably makes you wince and groan, but it almost looks like magic the way this happens. Is it always simple? If you have a biological sample that is relatively fresh, can you always chart those differences, those changes that you were talking about?
Well, I am asked that question quite a lot, and my typical response is it's pretty realistic, except we can't do it in 37 minutes plus commercials.
Right.
And when we do get a match, the suspect's picture doesn't pop up on the screen. Other than that, they have very good scientific advisors who work with the shows. And the fact of the matter is, with fresh samples, it's really very easy to get a DNA profile. If we have a blood stain, typically if that blood stain hasn't been exposed to environmental insult, we have no problems getting a DNA profile. Now, with some of the things that we work on, which are skeletal remains that may have been buried for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, even DNA after a long period of time exposed to the elements, exposed to environmental insult or acid in the soil, acid in the air, will begin to degrade. But with the techniques that we have and the techniques that we're developing, we should be able to get profiles from just about most things.
So is there a particular, if you have, and I, people will need to forgive the graphic nature of some of this conversation, but that's what we're talking about today. If you have a body that you are trying to identify, is there a particular, would you rather have a fingernail clipping or a piece of hair or a bit of skin if you were going to test?
Well, the best samples, the long-term samples, are skeletal remains, typically the long bones in our body. Those tend to have the greatest residue of cells that will survive. It's called compact bone. Typically, if you have a fresh sample, anything is good. Now, you mentioned hair. Hair itself, if it's a growing hair and a hair is physically plucked out, you get the cells that form the hair. However, and hair is probably the most common sample found at crime scenes, but the hair we find mostly at crime scenes are shed hair. So I need to tell you about there are two different types of DNA. There's the nuclear DNA, which I spoke of. That's what we get from our half from our mother and half from our father. There's a second type of DNA in the cell, and that's called mitochondrial DNA. Now, if you remember back to your biology, your chemistry, mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell. They generate the energy. They look like these little cigar-shaped organelles that are you can have several hundred copies per cell. And that's what generates the energy. Within the mitochondria is its own circular piece of DNA. And what's interesting is our mitochondria are only inherited maternally from the egg. So we tend to look at both types of DNA. There are only a handful of labs in the country that are typically able to look at mitochondrial DNA. Now, when we're referring to either shed hair or skeletal remains, in shed hair, you don't have the cell. You don't have the root. And as a hair actually develops, it's a hollow shaft. And the cytoplasm, that is the substance that the nucleus and all the different parts of the cell are in, it's actually shed into the hair. It's extruded. As the hair grows, this hollow shaft gets filled with some of the cytoplasm, which carries mitochondrial DNA. So in shed hairs, the only type of DNA typically we can look at are mitochondrial DNA. Now, what's really nice about mitochondrial DNA is anyone along a maternal lineage. So my grandmother gave her mitochondrial DNA to my mother, who gave it to me. Now, I don't pass along my mitochondrial DNA, but my sister has two nieces. I have two nieces, and their children will pass the mitochondrial DNA. So the beauty of mitochondrial DNA is when we're trying to locate individuals who'll be useful for testing, which are, you know, family, close family relatives, with mitochondria we can actually find more distant relatives as long as it's along the same maternal lineage.
So please continue.
No, so, so mitochondrial DNA is very significant in dealing with highly degraded or other samples other than, let's say, a blood stain. Now, today, reference samples are just we take something analogous to a cotton swab and we rub the inside of the cheek. We no longer have to take blood. Since every cell in your body has the same DNA, we can get your DNA profile from any cell. And typically, it's fairly easy to do. And so we could do it with blood, buccal samples, or any type of sample left at a crime scene. But with shed hair, we have to use the mitochondrial DNA. And with some old bones, typically, we have to typically do mitochondrial DNA testing in addition to getting small amounts of nuclear DNA.
Forgive me, what's a buccal sample?
Buccal sample is just our buccal. It's just the sample that you rub. You collect it by rubbing the inside of your cheek.
Okay, that's the cheek scraping.
Cheek scrape.
All right, so if you're looking for a criminal suspect and you have some DNA evidence, obviously that information that you have is only as good as a database somewhere, assuming that you don't have a suspect in custody to test
right.
it against. How are these databases coming together? How are they shared by law enforcement agencies?
Well, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, started a program called CODIS. CODIS stands for the Combined DNA Indexing System. And it's our national repository of DNA samples. CODIS exists at three levels. A local level, for instance, we're a local CODIS lab in Fort Worth. We're also the CODIS lab for missing persons for the state of Texas. The state in Austin, the DPS lab, which is the state crime lab, has the state level of CODIS. So any samples found in Texas, in Fort Worth, in Dallas, are first uploaded to the state level. And then if they meet certain requirements from the state level, they go up to the national level called ENDIS. Now, when samples are first collected from crimes, they're searched at a local level. So those of us who collect reference samples for different reasons, we can search them at our local level. Now, the state is the state laboratory. So anyone who's been convicted of crimes by state law, and every state has passed laws requiring the collection of samples, they're then compared between labs in Texas. So all local labs feed in Texas to the DPS in Austin. And in the Austin, you can compare samples, reference samples to crime scene samples, crime samples to other crime scene samples. So we can make associations at the state level. If no associations are made at the state level, then Texas, the DPS, will then send all the profiles up to the FBI where they can compare against other states. So there are two major databases, and I'll tell you about them. First is the samples collected at crime scenes that they do not match at the local or state level. Those crime scene samples are then sent up to the national level. We have all the convicted offender samples from each of the states, and there's approximately 12 to 13 million samples in the convicted offender profile databases. Now, about half the states have passed laws allowing the collection of samples on arrestees. Hmm. And very recently, within the last 2 months, the Supreme Court has ruled in a 5-4 decision that it is legal to collect samples from arrestees. There was some controversy whether or not that should be allowed. But the Supreme Court ruled that it's no more invasive than collecting fingerprints or any other type of a sample, as long as it's used for the sole purpose of trying to identify an individual associated with a crime or identify an individual who may be associated with a crime. So those are the main databases. Now, there are other databases that we are the major contributor to, and that's for missing persons and human remains. There are three databases related to that.
Let me jump in here. We're going to take a
sure.
quick break. We'll talk about those databases in just a minute. My guest is Art Eisenberg, chair of the Department of Forensic and Investigative Genetics at UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth and director of the Center for Human Identification. If you've got a question or you want to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Arthur Eisenberg, chair of the Department of Forensic and Investigative Genetics at UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth and director of the Center for Human Identification. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Art, before the break, you mentioned these three additional databases that exist.
Sure. And those are the databases that are typically populated with either unidentified human remains, family reference samples. Those are individuals who are looking for a loved one. And the third is a direct reference sample. For instance, if a child goes missing, a parent may have saved their baby teeth or something that contains DNA from that individual. Mm-hmm. And so we are the major contributors in the United States to those three databases. We have approximately half of all the unidentified human remains that are at the national level, as well as probably 60 to 70% of all the family reference samples, and then a percentage of the direct reference samples.
I'll have to confess, before I started reading up for this interview, I had no idea how many missing persons there are in the U.S. on any given day.
Well, on any given day, there are between 85 and 100,000 long-term missing individuals. The number of remains is really a guesstimate because medical examiners, coroners, never really kept very good statistics. After a while, they bury bodies in unmarked graves or Jane or John Doe's. They'd cremate them without retention of any samples. The best guess that we use is that back in the mid 2000, 2005, 2007, we guesstimated there are probably 40,000 or more unidentified human remains that existed in the country. And what's interesting is that when we actually are able to look at those remains, and I have to correct one thing. I'm the co-director
of
the UNT Center for Human Identification. My other director is Dr. Harold Gil King up at the University of North Texas in Denton. And it's really been an incredible partnership between the two campuses. Gil is the head of the Laboratory of Forensic Anthropology, and I'm the lab director of the, we call it the Lab Molecular Identification. But When medical examiners and anthropologists started looking at these remains, probably 50% or more of them, those individuals have been murdered. They didn't die of natural causes. So, you know, what we do is really two things. We try and identify the human remains really to provide families with information. Unfortunately, it's the worst information that their loved one is deceased. But I can't even imagine, you know, I have three daughters and four grandchildren waking up not knowing even 5 minutes where they are, yet families wake up 10 years, 20 years, 30 years or more not knowing where their loved one is. So by comparing these reference samples that families contribute to all the remains that we've processed or all the remains that have been processed and uploaded into the National DNA Indexing System, we can make these identifications. And it's pretty amazing the successes that we've had over the last literally only 10 years.
Of course, DNA in isolation can't tell a loved one what happened to the person they cared about, but sometimes the surrounding evidence from the recovery of the body can suggest what took place.
That's absolutely true. Typically, when we're dealing with remains, it's really the forensic anthropologist, and the team up at UNT and Denton are some of the finest in the country. By looking at these remains, they can find minute information relative to if it was a result of a knife wound or something like that. Certainly, if you have a skull and you see this big gaping hole that they can match up with an entry and an exit, a bullet wound or something like that. But yes, unfortunately, there are a lot of individuals that have died at someone else's hand. And really, the other thing that we can do is it's almost impossible to start a murder investigation if you don't know who the victim is. Mm-hmm. So by identifying those skeletal remains, not only can we provide families with something perhaps that can give them some measure of closure, but we can provide that first investigative lead to try and identify the perpetrator of the crime. And we've been very successful. Not only have we made nearly 1,200 identifications using DNA testing, a number of them have been cold hits that have actually led to identifying the perpetrator of the crime.
So I think a lot of people will find it impressive that we have a center of sort of international renown here in North Texas. But I have to ask you, why North Texas? Why is this a priority? Why has this become a priority for the UNT Health Science Center?
Well, actually, it was the love of a good woman who brought me to Texas. You know, we developed DNA testing at a company I was with in the 1980s, a company called Life Codes. And I was recruited to come to Texas in 1989, and that was really my specialty. It's using DNA testing for parentage testing. We work with the Office of Child Support Enforcement through the state's attorney general's office. Plus, at the time, there were very few DNA labs that existed, not only in Texas, but in the country. So one of my jobs was really to work with DNA labs really here in Texas and across the country to try and develop these programs. But it was really the partnership with the Denton School, with Dr. Gil King. He's been in Texas for more years than I have, and he's been a leading forensic anthropologist. And when the two of us got together, like sparks flew, and we thought that we had something that was unique. And in 2001, the state legislature here in Texas passed a bill creating the Texas Missing Persons DNA Database. We were operational in 2003. In 2004, the federal government, National Institute of Justice, had money in what's called the President's DNA Initiative, and we were the first recipient of funds to try and provide these services for the whole nation. There are really only two labs that do the type of work that I'm talking about across the country. It's our lab and the FBI's laboratory. There are a few other labs, maybe six or so other than the FBI and our lab, that do this work. But really across the country, it's our lab and the FBI that are providing these services for the states.
Is the impediment sort of the initial capital outlay? Is it finding trained people to do the collection and analysis necessary?
A little of both. It is, the state of Texas gave us initially, the attorney general was John Cornyn. And he actually delivered to us a check for $1 million from the state legislature and to start the laboratory. And we get money from the state legislature each year to provide some of the services. And we do get awards. We've been very fortunate that we've been getting federal grants from the National Institute of Justice. We've been the leading grantee relative to doing missing persons and human identification. We also operate another program for the federal government. It's called NAMIS, the National and National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. That's why I say NAMIS. It's a lot easier to get that out. And we do this work across the country. One of the other great things is because we have a great team of forensic anthropologists at the UNT campus, and I've been able to bring together a tremendous group of the leading scientists in DNA for human identification up at the Health Science Center, we started a graduate program where we actually train individuals to be DNA analysts. We have a master's degree program. It's about 2 years. And we train people from all over the country, from other countries. They come to Texas, to Fort Worth, to learn the techniques, the technology, and be trained to go back to their own states or their own countries. In fact, here in Texas, most of all new DNA analysts have been trained at our lab in the last 5 or 6 years or so.
So you make it sound like everybody was clamoring for this from the moment it became available. Were there law enforcement agencies initially that said, we don't need this new science, we're fine with sort of doing things the way they've always been done, or did everyone recognize the potential of this immediately?
Well, it started off somewhat slowly. Virginia was one of the first states that was an early adopter of the technology. In fact, Texas, actually Fort Worth, was one of the first areas that used DNA testing in the mid-1980s to try cases. The fact is that, as I said, it's very difficult to commit a crime and not leave some type of biological sample. And the techniques and technologies that were used before DNA just were not as sensitive. Samples would degrade more easily when you're talking about proteins. DNA is much more resistant. And it just caught on. It just became sort of the wave. And if you were a police agency and you did not have a DNA lab, you were somewhat considered a lesser type of agency. So all large police stations, large cities, all developed their DNA programs.
How is this technology applied to the problem of missing children?
Well, besides the program that we use here in the United States, essentially collecting samples, we work very closely with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, who handle cases of anyone under the age of 18 are considered a child. We use this technology all over the world. A very good friend of mine, Dr. Jose Lorente from Granada, Spain, is probably one of the most well-known forensic geneticists in Latin America. And he travels continuously throughout Mexico, Central America, South America. And he would always see children living on the streets or living in orphanages. And he thought that there was something that could be done using DNA testing. And from that, a program called DNA Pro Kids has sprung forth. And Jose allowed us to partner with him. I've known Jose for about 20 years. We met at the FBI. And the idea was to try and develop DNA databases, two DNA databases in countries that are very prone to human trafficking. There are three types of countries classified in the world: a source country where these children come from, a destination country where they're sold to, and a transit country where sort of an intermediary till they're sold to who's ever buying them. And United Nations has recognized, and it's true, human trafficking is the second largest criminal activity in the world behind drug trafficking. At any one time, there are millions of young women and children that are trafficked. And those of us who live in the United States don't realize how much we're affected by it, because the destination countries are typically the more industrial countries. United States is absolutely a destination country where children are trafficked not only into this country, but within the country itself. So what DNA Pro Kids is, we're trying to develop two databases, one where families can come forward and provide their reference sample to try and identify their child who's gone missing. Now, the second database is made up of children who are living on the street, who are in orphanages, or rescued from these forced prostitution rings, or rescued from these slave labor type of businesses. We call them sweatshops. And the idea is to compare these two databases not only within a country, but DNA Pro Kids was set up to be able to compare these profiles between countries. And it's only been around for maybe a dozen years. The first pilot studies were done in Guatemala. And you might say, why Guatemala? Well, in 2007, 25% of all international adoptions into the United States came from the small country, Guatemala. And when DNA Pro Kids looked at the first 230 cases, 90 of them, there was no biological relationship between the child and the individual, the adult presenting them for adoption. Basically, these children had been stolen and they were sold for legal adoption. The U.S. State Department stopped, put a moratorium on these adoptions, and now laws have been passed in Guatemala that it's become very difficult to do that anymore. You know, 40% or so of those adoptions that we looked at a snapshot in time, 2007, there was no, you know, these children had been kidnapped. So Jose started this program, and the Health Science Center has partnered with them. We've looked at about 10,000 samples worldwide. We also are doing this. There are about 15 to 17 countries that have partnered with DNA Pro Kids. So out of the first 10,000 samples that we've processed from adults and children, almost 700 children have been identified and returned to their families. There are those that have been identified, but it wasn't best for the children to return them. We've prevented almost 240 or so illegal adoptions, and it's been very successful in its infancy. I always sort of tear up about this. Dr. Lorente was approached probably about two, 3 months ago from an emissary from the Pope. And the Pope has realized about how severe and how significant this problem of human trafficking is. So on November 2nd and 3rd, the Pope is convening a meeting at the Vatican, a closed meeting, with experts from around the world to talk about human trafficking. Human trafficking is basically the primary group is young women, 18 to 24, and children. Those are those individuals who have been trafficked. And the Pope, in his message to Jose, was, I know about the problem. I don't want to hear about the problem. I want to hear about solutions. And he wants him to present on DNA Pro Kids.
Hmm. Do you think some of the problem, some of the reason that this problem has grown so large is lack of awareness among members of the general public? Is it lack of political will?
Well, I don't. It's hard to believe that it's a lack of awareness. Certainly, I think there are people who choose not to think about it. There have been very few successful prosecutions around the world. It's like drug trafficking. We don't think that we can stop human trafficking, especially of children. I mean, I don't think we're that naive. We are hoping at best we can deter it. We can slow it down. Human trafficking has become such a big business, billions and billions and billions of dollars. It's expanded to such terrible things as organ trafficking. That is, people who might be in waiting lists for transplants. There are wealthy people around the world who will do anything to stay alive. They'll have people killed to harvest their organs. So that's one growing area. You know, these labor camps where they're just put to work, working 15, 17 hours a day for minimum or no pay. It's such a big business, as it was in Guatemala. Adoption services were, you know, $100 to $200 million business in Guatemala. And unfortunately, at the time, the government was part of it. Wealthy individuals, law firms were part of it. U.S. families were just going there to try and adopt a child, not knowing that, you know, they thought everything was legal and it was in the up and up. And they pay $30,000 to $40,000 to try and get them a healthy child who they could raise as their own and give them a good life, yet they didn't know that there was a possibility that that child had been stolen from their parents.
My guest is Dr. Arthur Eisenberg, co-director of the Center for Human Identification. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Arthur Eisenberg, who is chair of the Department of Forensic and Investigative Genetics at UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth and co-director of the Center for Human Identification. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Mike who says, since your training is scientific in nature, what is your opinion of eyewitness testimony? I understand that human eyewitnesses have proven to be among the most unreliable in many circumstances, but are still admissible in court. Why is scientific evidence often rejected while eyewitness testimony accepted?
Well, you're absolutely right. We have learned that eyewitness testimony is not as reliable as we once thought. And that's why DNA testing has become even more valuable, because one of the things that has developed from the work that we did at Life Codes back in New York is the Innocence Project. Two New York attorneys who actually have done a lot of work here in Texas, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, started their career, the Innocence Project, based upon cases done using DNA testing. And since they've begun this project, hundreds of individuals have been exonerated based upon DNA testing, where initially they were convicted primarily based upon eyewitness testimony. So it's critically important that there be other information in addition to just someone saying, picking someone out of a lineup. And that's where the DNA testing becomes very, very important, because if you can get a full DNA profile, really the statistics are astronomical. We could say with high levels of certainty that that profile would not have been seen in basically anyone in the planet with the exception of that individual or an identical twin.
Can you talk about the work that you and your colleagues have done as regards the Dozier Boys school case?
Well, we're just starting to do the work. I don't know if we've actually received samples as of yet. The Dozier School for Boys was something like a reform school where individuals, young boys, were sent. And over the years, many have disappeared. I think it's long closed. But families were told that their loved one had run away or disappeared or died. And due to exhumations on that campus, they're now finding a large number of bodies, skeletal remains, that probably were many of these boys who the claim was that they disappeared. So forensic anthropologists from Florida are excavating the campus there. And I think that they've found at least 70 more bodies to this point. And we routinely have been doing most of the work in terms of the human remains from Florida as well as many other states. And we anticipate that very soon we're going to be getting these bodies. Plus, law enforcement has been reaching out to the families of anyone who in Florida or any other state who may have had a loved one, a relative, that had been sent to the Dozier School and never returned.
Can you talk about, I mean, obviously there are times when you can see justice done as a result of your work, but you're also forced to come face-to-face with a lot of really inhuman behavior and activity. How do you sort of keep going and keep an optimistic attitude on the really bad days?
Well, you know, have seen a lot. You know, we've identified, as I say, you know, many, many human remains. We've seen the forensic work that we do. We've been involved in some horrific crimes. You know, what keeps us going is one that we can, as a teacher, we can provide families with information. And, you know, as I said, hope to God you and I never know what the term closure means, you know, for a family who's missing a loved one, especially a child. But you know, as the other thing that's these individuals who've killed, there's nothing to stop them from killing again. And, you know, the hope is that by the work we do, we can't save that last victim, but perhaps we could save the next victim. And that's what really keeps us going, you know, doing the job we do. I've been here at the university for nearly 24 years, and I love what I do because not only do I help train other people to continue and hopefully do things better than we've been able to do, but I do believe we save lives.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Steve in Mesquite. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, very well, thank you.
I used to work at a DNA testing facility that was in Dallas. And we would do some forensics. It was mostly paternity testing. But we would do forensics for small towns, police departments. And we would get phone calls from policemen telling us that they wanted a guarantee that we would work with them. In other words, they wanted us to guarantee that we would say the matches were positive, even if they weren't. Hmm. And I always thought that was incredibly frightening. There should be some laws that say that they can't take your DNA until they've already tested it from what they thought they picked up at the crime scene.
Thanks for your call. What do you want to say about that, Art?
Well, one of the nice things that has happened is that there have been a lot of funds made available through the federal government that allow us to do the testing, as well as many other labs, to do the testing really at no charge. We will take cases from any organization, any law enforcement agency within the state of Texas, and do that work no charge. As far as the reference samples are concerned, It used to be that you have to have been previously convicted of a crime to get the reference samples, but now the Supreme Court said that it is legal to collect samples from arrestees and then test them against databases that exist of crime scene samples. One of the things that's being developed is what's called rapid DNA technology. The idea is that if an individual's found at a booking station, they have some reason to have arrested them, they can't keep them indefinitely without charging them. And the idea being with these new technologies, we can collect the samples and then search databases very quickly and then provide perhaps additional information.
Can you imagine a future where if you want a Social Security card or if you want a driver's license, you have to submit to a cheek swab?
Well, many countries are actually thinking about that now. That is, many countries have these ID cards, and the idea being to use the add the DNA profile to these cards. There were programs that were started in the 90s where any child that was born, their family can have a DNA profile produced. At the same time, every child has a heel stick done for certain prenatal, neonatal genetic tests. That same sample can be used to create a DNA profile. That DNA profile could be held by the parents, and in the event of something catastrophic like they've disappeared, that profile could be used to search for them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Javier in Dallas. Hi, Javier.
Hi. Great show. One quick question. I've been receiving from my school, from my daughter's school, a paper that says that we can provide DNA and information from my child in case something catastrophic happened, like the doctor said. But my concern is, how am I going to be sure that information in the future is not going to be used to deny my daughter social services or a job or something because she's probably going to get cancer or because of her genome, they study that and they're going to see that she's going to get something. How can I know that it's going to be safe, that information?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, first and foremost, there are laws that protect that sample. Our laboratory really only does, we only look at regions of DNA. They code for no functional genes. They're not involved in any type of genetic diseases. The sole purpose is for human identification. There are very few, if any, labs that I'm aware of that, in terms of police agencies and criminal justice, that have the ability to use that DNA for anything more than developing a profile for identification. I think that's a valid concern, but I think the U.S. government has certainly recognized this and has essentially developed laws that protect the genetic privacy of individuals. So we can't just take a sample and then use it at some later point to determine a risk for certain diseases or anything like that, that genetic privacy is protected in this country.
Going back to the question we had from our caller earlier who said he'd worked at a DNA lab and sometimes would be told by police detectives or other representatives, you know, they were hoping the lab would work with them. Is that something that happens in your experience, and how incontrovertible is DNA evidence?
Well, I've never experienced that where a law enforcement agency has asked us to manufacture results. Obviously, that's criminal, and we would never be part of that. I would never be part of that. A DNA profile can't be changed. The DNA profile you're born with is the DNA profile you die with. Now, certainly there can be mistakes, but we've put the controls into place. I was part of what was called the DNA Advisory Board, which was established by Congress that gave the authority to the director of the FBI to establish national standards for doing DNA testing. And I believe that we've developed standards that protect from things like that from happening. But it's a test that involves people. People can make mistakes. Now, can people make mistakes on purpose to try and alter the results? I think it would be very difficult to alter the results to include someone. You can more easily make a mistake that would exclude somebody as a potential contributor. but you'd have to be essentially work very hard to defeat the system with all the controls that are in place to try and manufacture results.
I know that you have partnered with the Dallas Police Department's Prostitution Diversion Program. And first of all, explain briefly for us how that works and how individuals are sort of made candidates for giving a DNA sample.
Well, again, it was sort of serendipitous. Sergeant Louis Fellini was really the developer of the program in the Dallas Police Office, and his wife, Dr. Martha Fellini, worked at the School of Public Health at the UNT Health Science Center. You know, when I first met Sergeant Fellini, he worked essentially the prostitution and the prostitution that occurred at these very large truck stops. And it was every once a month on a Wednesday night, they'd have these raids and they'd arrest these women for prostitution. And these women would go and they'd essentially bail out or they'd be let out. And it was just this sort of roller coaster, this of getting arrested and being released, yet nothing was being done to help them. And the idea between the PDI, the Prostitute Diversion Initiative, was to try and get these women help. And what they were able to do is they put together about 50 different social service agencies. They set up this little city in order to help these women. And when these women were arrested, they had representatives from the judiciary that, you know, said that if you got into this program, we'd get you help in terms of drug intervention, chemical intervention, and they were going to try and help them get jobs and essentially rehabilitate themselves. And if they volunteered, they also could contribute a reference sample. Now, the reason that I was so amazed by this program is it was fairly well known that a number of serial killers had been associated with the trucking industry, a fairly good number of individuals. And once these women had gotten into the cabs of these trucks, they're at the mercy of, you know, some bad people. And the idea is that the bodies had been found, dumped off major highways in different states. And Texas is really sort of one of the hubs into the United States. And once in Texas, they can essentially go on interstates and go throughout the state.
We just have about 10 to 15 seconds left, so if you want to.
So the idea was that we offered to, if they sent us these profiles, we'd set up a database of women who voluntarily contributed their samples. Regardless of what they did, they're someone's loved one, they're someone's mother, they're someone's sister, and they had a right to identify these women no matter what they did. And that's what we tried to do.
In the event that the worst happens.
And we actually made our first identification of an individual.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Arthur Eisenberg is chair of the Department of Forensic and Investigative Genetics at UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth and co-director of the Center for Human Identification. Art, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. We had help on the phones from Christina Martinez. Lindsay Connect produced the show, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.